From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Marianne Evans wrote in the heart of the Victorian age under the pen name George Eliot. A proto-feminist, she made her own way at a time when that was not easy. Her book, Middlemarch, is hailed by some big writers as the best novel ever. New Yorker writer Rebecca Mead has Middlemarch as a kind of guide to life, read and reread and drawn on the wisdom here. That's what she's done. She's gone back again and again to George Eliot's remarkable eye on the nuances of life and love. This hour on Point, Rebecca Mead on what she's learned in George Eliot's Middlemarch. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you ready to be schooled, made wise by a brilliant Victorian woman named George? Are you already there? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Rebecca Mead, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, born and raised in Southwest England. She's now a woman of Brooklyn and still a reader of George Eliot. Her new book, just out, is a blend of memoir, close reading, and literary biography. It's called My Life in Middlemarch. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Rebecca Mead, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. I'm delighted to be here.
You say that Middlemarch has disciplined your character. In what direction and how?
I've been reading Middlemarch since I was 17 years old. The first time I encountered it was as a student attempting to enter Oxford University. And I've read it just about every 5 years since then. And every time I go back to it, I feel as if I learn more from it about myself. I learn more from it about the world. And so I feel as if it has knit itself into me, and I don't quite know what I would be without it at this point.
What did you first learn from it on your first reading, going back to this 19th century novel as a young woman, teenager maybe, in what, the 70s?
It was the 80s.
Okay.
When I was 17, mm-hmm. and mid-80s. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I recognized the yearnings of a young woman in this book. The first character we're introduced to is Dorothea Brooke, who is 19 years old at the outset of Middlemarch and is yearning for a more significant life. She lives in a provincial town and she wants to do something with her life, but she doesn't quite know what that is. And when I first read it, I too was living in a provincial town and yearning to get away from it and yearning to do something, to have an intellectual life, which wasn't the kind of home that I grew up in and wasn't the sort of background I came from. So I didn't know exactly what it was that I wanted, but I knew I wanted more. And I recognized very much myself in this ardent, longing character of Dorothea Brooke.
You were English, so maybe the Victorian-era language was no impediment. It somehow reads to me even more Victorian than Jane Austen earlier, of course. Was there a barrier there in kind of breaking through to the great wisdom and insight that's in here? It's a very different rhythm of prose.
It is, but I think that the modernity of the emotions that are described haven't changed. I mean, there are certain, you know, there are words describing dresses that I still don't know what they mean exactly,
right.
Or modes of transportation that I don't recognize. But that didn't matter then, and it doesn't really matter to me now either. I think that what George Eliot was so wonderful at doing was taking her reader inside the emotions of her characters. And that hasn't changed. People still fall in love. People still fall in love with the wrong people. People still have intellectual ambitions that they want to fulfill or fail to fulfill. And people are still trying to figure out what their duties are to themselves, to their parents, to each other. And all those things don't change very much.
At 17, it was about aspiring for something substantive and deep and significant. When did you come back to it next, Rebecca?
Well, I came back to it as a student, and then I came back to it again in my mid-20s when I was thinking about love and relationships and what I wanted out of those things. I didn't get married until I was in my 30s, mm-hmm. but I was thinking about what a marriage might be and what a good marriage would consist of. And so when I came back to it at 25, for example, it was very much concerned with what is one looking for in a partner, and where can this go wrong, and how fatally, tragically mistaken can one be in choosing a partner to spend one's life with?
And right on through her, what you're still not fully extended. Well, you're just in middle age now, but you've come back to it. I want to catch a little bit from Middlemarch, just to give listeners a sense of this. Some may have read it and read it deeply and reread it like yourself. Others may never have touched it. You've got a little excerpt here. This is Dorothy's notions about marriage. This is a time when she's thinking, well, she'd be happy even to marry a much older man if he was wise and penetrating enough in his understanding of life and the world. People will recognize John Milton in here, Paradise Lost. Hooker, they may not. I don't know, is that Thomas or Richard or one of those?
Richard Hooker,
one
yes.
of those great hookers. Could you, right. could you read for us a bit?
Of course. Dorothea, with all her eagerness to know the truths of life, retained very childlike ideas about marriage. She felt sure that she would have accepted the judicious Hooker if she had been born in time to save him from that wretched mistake he made in matrimony, or John Milton when his blindness had come on, or any of the other great men whose odd habits it would have been glorious piety to endure. But an amiable, handsome baronet who said exactly to her remarks even when she expressed uncertainty, how could he affect her as a lover? The really delightful marriage must be that where your husband was a sort of father and could teach you even Hebrew if you wished it.
A young woman who's prepared to marry John Milton, the blind John Milton, even if his odd habits would have been glorious piety to endure. Did you embrace that, or did George Eliot show you to be wiser?
Well, I wouldn't say that George Eliot didn't give me sort of a guidebook to life. She didn't give me rules to live by, and I've made many mistakes of my own. But what I do feel is that Middlemarch has been a guide through my life. It has been standing beside me as I go through my life. And what it has given me now in middle age is a lens through which I can look back at the life I've lived and to understand the moves I've made, using the language and using the ideas and using the examples that she describes in Middlemarch. So I feel, you know, I think it would be a mistake to look at Middlemarch as a guide to life. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, a great book can be with you and can be your companion through life. And that is what Middlemarch has been to me.
We want to dig on into George Eliot's insights, but just stepping back for a second, I mean, there was a time, I think, and you write about this, when in the era of Virginia Woolf and others, this was considered kind of small bore Victorian stuff. But then it has come back to the point where Martin Amis, Julian Barnes, others have called it the greatest novel in the English language. You're pretty fond of it yourself. How do people put that huge superlative, why, on this book, Middlemarch?
It is so rich. It is so funny, as you can tell from that excerpt that I just read.
Yes.
It's wonderfully ironic, even if you don't know who Richard Hooker is, and it doesn't matter.
Marrying blind old John Milton, because he's such a great man, he'll teach you Hebrew if you feel like it.
It's just delightful, and you know, people feel that, you know, people worry about reading an 800-page book, and it looks very forbidding, but it's really not, and it's absolutely draws you in and holds you close, but it has great wisdom, as we've said. It has tremendous empathy of the authorial voice. You know, George Eliot was in her 50s when she wrote this book, and so it's mostly about the trials of young people figuring out what they're going to do with their lives. But it's written from this perspective of wisdom and compassion and empathy, which I think is, you know, profoundly moving to read and to come back to in middle age when one has hopefully developed some of those characteristics oneself.
Empathy is a giant word and idea here, maybe revolutionary in its own way at the time. Rebecca Mead writes, the questions with which George Eliot showed her characters wrestling would all be mine eventually. And they were in her life and maybe every considered life. She writes, how is wisdom to be attained? What are the satisfactions of personal ambition? And how might they be weighed against ties and duties to others? What does a good marriage consist of? And what makes a bad one? What do the young owe to the old and vice versa? What is the proper foundation of morality? That is a groaning board of the big questions, Rebecca.
Well, it does pose these big questions, but it doesn't do it in a heavy-handed and off-putting way, I feel. I mean, George Eliot did believe in the ability of fiction to generate moral improvement. But it's also true that plenty of people who don't have very good morals can read and enjoy great literature too. I think that reading books, Middlemarch and other books, can help us to learn to extend our sympathies, to put ourselves into the perspective of another. And that's what she does with Middlemarch. She carries us through and puts us in the perspective of each of the characters and then moves it so that we have to understand that somebody else feels slightly differently. And that's really the moral core of Middlemarch. And I think that reading fiction can do that for people. I think all serious readers share that experience that reading a great novel can make you a broader, wider person because you've had to be in somebody else's head for a while.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about life, love, wisdom, and the great Victorian novel Middlemarch by George Eliot, brought to life again by New Yorker writer Rebecca Mead's new book, My Life in Middlemarch. Rebecca Mead joins us from New York. She grew up reading Middlemarch and has read it then again and again at different phases of her life and found new meaning each time, new, well, broadly guidance or ways to think about the challenges of life with all the insight George Eliot could bring to it and that she finds in her reading. Your book is about the text of Middlemarch. It's about your own life and how the text is woven through it. And it's about George Eliot. Tell us more about her, her life, and why she took the pen name George.
Well, she was born in 1819 in a provincial town in England. She moved to London in her late 20s, early 30s, and became a critic and editor. And she didn't start writing fiction until she was in her 30s. She took the pen name George Eliot in part because she was a notorious woman by the time she was writing fiction. She was living out of wedlock with her partner, George Henry Lewes, with whom she lived for 24 years with great happiness. But it was a scandalous thing to do. And so she needed a pseudonym and she chose a masculine one, I think, to acquire the seriousness, too, that a male author would be accorded, that a woman wouldn't necessarily be accorded at that time. But she also was a notorious woman. She couldn't write under her own name.
Where did she get the effrontery or the courage to live that self-defined life in the Victorian age?
Well, she was an astonishingly bold person. I mean, she grew up in a provincial town to parents who were not educated. She acquired her own education through great force of will. She was extraordinarily erudite. She was completely brilliant. And she was fearless, and she lived against convention. Although she would have married George Henry Lewes had she been able to. It wasn't that she was defying marriage. There's no writer I can think of who thinks more seriously about what marriage is, what marriage should be. And I've thought a lot about my own marriage in the context of what I've learned from Middlemarch. But she had to be with the person that she loved. She had to live out of wedlock, and she made enormous sacrifices personally to do that, with friends and family cutting her off and society at large thinking of her as scandalous.
Here's a little scene from the BBC's 1994 adaptation of George Eliot's Middlemarch. Here's Dorothea, played by Juliet Aubrey. She talks to the listener about the lives of women, of being free to be oneself, and how years and relationships can make that ever harder.
I used to despise women for not shaping their lives more. I was so fond of doing as I liked. 2 years ago, I had no notion of the way that trouble comes and ties our hands and makes us silent when we long to speak.
The BBC's Middlemarch from 1994. Rebecca Mead's new book is My Life in Middlemarch. David's calling from Groton, Massachusetts. David, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I was delighted to hear this topic. Love this novel. Someone just asked me a couple weeks ago what my favorite novel was, and after thinking for a few minutes, I named Middlemarch. Just and then started rereading it again for the nth time. I wonder what your author sees as a connective arc from Austen through the Brontes. And I would just observe quickly that one of the things that's delightful about this novel is found also in Proust, namely the entry into the inner lives of individuals. And I'll take the comments off the air.
Wonderful, David. Thank you. You remind us, Rebecca, that George Eliot read Jane Austen as she was wading into this project, Middlemarch.
She did. She was an admirer, as was George Henry Lewis, one of the first and earliest advocates of Jane Austen's works. And George Eliot, in anticipation, really, of writing her own fiction, went back and read all of Austen to psych herself up in some sense. And the beginning of Middlemarch has this very Austenian tone. We are introduced to these two young marriageable women, and it looks like it's going to be that kind of a story. But then it broadens out into a much wider panorama of a whole town and a whole variety of people. She took that kind of social observation that much further. But she said she was definitely indebted to Austen, who came before her.
And what about on the other side, heading toward Proust, like and unlike? Proust is another who's, you know, some people have just been obsessed with, fixated on, never stop reading and illuminating their own lives through Proust. How do you give us a little compare and contrast here?
Yeah, well, she you know, D.H. Lawrence said of George Eliot, she was the first to put the action inside. She was the first to give us psychological portraits of her characters, really to take us inside their minds. And so she does anticipate all kinds of writers who follow her. As you said, you know, she went a little out of fashion in the immediate aftermath of the Victorian era because, you know, those people wanted to distance themselves and separate themselves from their predecessors. But she laid the ground for all kinds of writers who followed her, from Lawrence to Virginia Woolf to all sorts of others.
I mean, they wanted to separate themselves. Not, it was more than that, wasn't it? She followed, I don't know if she used this word or if it's your word or someone else, meliorism, to ameliorate, I guess, the difficulties and unkindnesses of the world through empathy and small acts of kindness and generosity, and turn that into kind of life discipline. But you write that World War I, with its terrible ferocity, its millions of fatalities, made that look small for a time.
Yeah, I think it did. And it's still hard to hold on to the idea that, you know, if you and I do small kind deeds to each other and to the people around us, then the world will gradually become a better place. But it can't hurt. And whether it's going to solve all of the world's problems, I don't know. But it is certainly a code that one might live by profitably, I think.
Certainly helps in a marriage. Doug is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Doug, you're on the air with Rebecca Mead.
Hi, my name again is Doug. I read Middlemarch two summers ago in a 19th century English novel class at Suwanee University in Tennessee at the School of Letters.
Great.
In an MA program. The professor was a brilliant woman by the name of Jen Lewin. And her comment that I remember from the class is that you had to have undergone a divorce to really appreciate some of the inner workings of Middlemarch. And I totally understand that. I was in a long-term marriage for 25 years that ended badly. And, you know, when the characters in Middlemarch are, to some extent, all trying to make their way in the world. And for Dorothea, she had to dust herself off. It wasn't what she thought in her marriage, and she moved on. And I think that's a great lesson. The other thing I remember about the book is Eliot portrays the characters in such an empathetic, compassionate way. It's almost a sweet book. It's a pleasant read, and I would strongly encourage anyone that hasn't read it to plow through it. It's a long book, but God, it's a great journey, and you'll be glad you did.
Oh, Doug, I'm so glad you called. Thank you for that, Doug. Hey, I have to ask you, I don't know if you're on to another marriage or romance, but will Middlemarch change the way you go about it, Doug? Oh, Doug may be off to that next
Doug
romance.
Is gone, yeah.
How about it? First, it's lessons on marriage, insights.
Yes, I mean, you know, it's my a friend of mine who teaches at Princeton similarly tells his students that they will not understand this book now, but they should read it again when they're 40 because they'll understand it better then, and that they should contact him and tell him what they understand now. But I think that, you know, reading it in middle age, for me, I see not just all kinds of insights into what marriage should be, but it also shows me, you know, it makes me see my parents' marriage in a different light. It makes me see my own marriage in a different light. There are so many different marriages that are shown in this book that either succeed or fatally are flawed from even the very beginning. The marriage of Tertius Lydgate and Rosamond is a fatal disaster for Lydgate, who has to abandon all of his hopes of becoming a great doctor and making great advances in science.
She imagined that he was like that John Milton, that great man, and finds it kind of a dusty nothing actually going on, and forces him to confront that.
Yeah, and he dies at 50, having been a doctor specializing in gout, which is a rich person's disease. Yeah. It's like being a plastic surgeon now or something. Yeah. It's tragic. And so she shows us how these marriages can work or not work, and gives us clues to think about as we're going into our own marriages. And luckily, these days, we don't have to get married to somebody sort of almost as soon as we've met them, which was the case for many of the characters in Middlemarch.
Doug mentions empathy. It's a word we toss around pretty lightly these days, but she really meditated on empathy in marriage and beyond. It's kind of the heart of a personal philosophy. Take us to the importance of empathy in her work and thinking.
Well, what I say in my life in Middlemarch is that the marriage is empathy in its smallest unit. I mean, what we must do in marriage is think ourselves all the time into the place of our partner, and mm-hmm. hopefully our partner will do the same to us. And so that sort of extension of that is what love is, right? That is mm-hmm. that is to feel with somebody else and to care for them as much as they care for us. And it seems like a simple thing to say, and yet it is hard, and it is hard every day in marriage to do that, and not to get wrapped up in one's own, problems and so on. So I think that reminder is something that's very, very important to the book Middlemarch, and it's also something that when I was writing my life in Middlemarch, I thought about an awful lot about how that had figured in my own life and my own sort of movement, I hope, from self-centeredness as a youth and being only concerned with my own life and how I was going to get on and get out, to a greater compassion and understanding of people around me, too.
Virginia Woolf said, of course, as you quote her, Middlemarch, one of the few English novels written for grown-up people. We could have arguments about that, but even so, and much more recently, I'm looking here in Newsweek, Alexander Nazarian writing about George Eliot and Middlemarch, and he says, comparing her very favorably to much more contemporary authors, Middlemarch will teach the bespectacled young man from Brooklyn or Austin or San Francisco far more about this business of living than all of Jonathan Franzen's feeble ejaculations. Okay, Victorians. Finbar, Columbia, South Carolina. Finbar, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I would love for your guest to read in a moment Casaubon's marriage proposal to Dorothea. It's written in the craziest, most obtuse language you can imagine. But it's very funny, and I'd also I'd like to remark on her tongue-in-cheek observation that male ignorance was of a much more admirable caliber than female ignorance, because it at least had the starch of tradition behind it, whereas female ignorance lacked that particular commodity.
Male ignorance fortified by tradition. We'll try and look at that, Finbar. Thank you for your call, Rebecca. I don't know if you have access to Casaubon's marriage proposal.
Oh, I'm paging through trying to find it, and I'm not sure I'm going to be able to. Ah, yes, I do. I have it. I'm not going to read the whole thing.
A little bit of that.
Very long.
Yes.
But I will read you a line from it. It's very long and very wordy, and he says, I have discerned in you an elevation of thought and a capability of devotedness which I had hitherto not conceived to be compatible either with the early bloom of youth or with those graces of sex that may be said at once to win and to confer distinction when combined, as they notably are in you, with the mental qualities above indicated. This is a love letter.
This is a proposal of marriage.
And when George Eliot wrote this, her publisher wrote back to her and said, it's very funny. Is it not too funny? I mean, wouldn't even Dorothea see through this? But the great tragedy of Dorothea's life is, at this stage at least, is that she so wants to believe that Casaubon is all that she dreams that he is this great mind that she is going to help
and support.
Yes, I meant
Casaubon earlier, of course, yes.
Yeah, and so, you know, she responds heartbreakingly, I think, to thanking him for his love, which he actually does not mention loving her in this proposal. But, you know, when I read that as a young person, I felt, as most of us do, I think, you know, sort of horrified and appalled by Casaubon, and he's so dry and awful, and how could she be doing this? And please don't do it, Dorothea. Now when I read it, you know, I'm the age that Casaubon is. And to read the whole novel and to see his own terror and fear of all that he hasn't accomplished and all that he had hoped to do and failed to do, and his own sense that she, rather than helping him, is judging him, and his own timorousness and closedness and his inability to love is so painful. And I can't help recognizing some of myself in that, as I think that anybody who's honest with themselves when they get to the middle of life sees that too.
We all fall short of our greatest aspirations, surely.
Well, perhaps we don't all, but most of us do. Yeah. And I think by the time one's middle-aged, at least, you know, it's hard not to have fallen short of something, surely. And so this period of life, you know, in which I wrote my book, I started it sort of when I was in my early 40s, and I'm now 47, and it was this moment of stopping and taking stock and thinking, well, where am I and how did I get here and where am I going to go next and what has Middlemarch been to me through those years and what can it tell me about where I'm going forward?
Empathy, even for our maybe inevitable failings. Janet in Brighton, Massachusetts. Janet, you're on the air with Rebecca Mead. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have to say, I just want to echo Rebecca Mead's thoughts. I taught college all my life, and my young people, when they found out I was married, more than once would ask me about marriage. And I'm not really a dogmatic person, but about this, I kind of was. I always said, okay, you young women, don't even think about getting married until you read Middlemarch. And you young men, don't even think about getting married until you read Jude the Obscure.
Stick with the young women for a second, Janet. Did they follow your advice? And if they did, what did you hope they would learn there that was key?
You know, I don't know whether none of them ever got back with me to tell me whether they followed my advice. I was hoping that they would learn mistakes not to make. I guess I was hoping they would learn from Dorothea, the character, not to project onto their young man.
That's good advice, Janet, right there. We're up against the clock, but I'm so happy for your call. Thank you for that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about life, love, wisdom, and the great Victorian novel Middlemarch by George Eliot, brought to life again by New Yorker writer Rebecca Mead's new book, My Life in Middlemarch. It's kind of a memoir of her own life. It is an exploration of George Eliot's life, and it is a deep exploration of the book itself, the great big book from the 19th century, 1870s, Middlemarch, A Study of Provincial Life, as her subtitle went. We asked our listeners, you know, was there a book that they read again and again that shapes their lives? And, you know, they're all over the place. I mean, wonderful books with Absalom and Walden, To Kill a Mockingbird, The Plague, Confederacy of Dunces, Catch-22, and right on down. I wonder when you knew that this would be your touchstone, and Why you, Rebecca, with this book instead of Austen or Faulkner or you name it?
Well, when I first read it, I knew that it was regarded as one of the great works of literature, and I was an aspiring intellectual, and I wanted to be one of those people that understood it and had summited this peak of English literature. So it mattered to me in that way. But then, you know, so in a sense, I sort of chose it as a youth. But then I also feel that it chose me. I mean, it spoke to me so differently every time I came back from, you know, in my 20s, as I said, when I was thinking about love and marriage. And then in my 30s, the stories of Tertius Lydgate and his aspirations to do great things and his sort of professional failings spoke very strongly to me. And then in my 40s, when I looked at the marriage of Fred Vincey and Mary Garth, who are the couple that come together as children and are betrothed in a mock marriage ceremony when they're children, and then marry at the very end of the book, I realized in my 40s were my parents. They were just like my parents, who had met when they were teenagers and married when they were 21 and were married for almost 60 years. And I understood my parents' long life together and their huge commitment to one another throughout their entire lives in a way that I had not understood and that I had not really appreciated at all before. When I was a young person, I wanted something very, very different from marrying the boy next door. And I moved away from town and I moved out of the country. I moved to America when I was in my early 20s. Mm-hmm. I wanted something extremely different. And Middlemarch gave me a way to appreciate what my parents had done and to respect and admire and wonder at the magnificence of a lifelong commitment, which for all the adventures that I've had is something that I will never have.
That response from you lines up, as you tell it, with George Eliot's own aspiration. She writes about this so-called inspiring principle, as you put it, that gave her courage to write. It was that so that Eliot said, presenting our human life as to help my readers in getting a clearer conception and a more active admiration of those vital elements which bind men together and give a higher worthiness to their existence. You say she took that satisfaction in producing work that would gladden and chasten human hearts. And your observation there is it's an aspiration with a distinctly religious resonance. I mean, she wanted to inspire, to lift up.
She did, and she had been a very religious young woman. As a teenager, she was sort of obnoxiously, priggishly devout. And I read, to write my book, I went back and read her letters, her teenage letters, which are sort of awful, but cringe-makingly awful. But they reminded me, too, of sort of cringe-makingly awful letters that I had written as a teenager. She was very devout, and then she lost her faith in her 20s when she sort of made an intellectual inquiry into the roots of Christianity. But she was always very concerned with how one could live a good life without God. She was profoundly concerned with ethics and what one should do in relation to one's fellow humans. And although I don't think of her books as didactic, I mean, there are occasional lapses or steps into it, but that's not what she's doing. What she's doing is showing us that experience and giving us as readers that experience of empathy and leading us through. And so, you know, Middlemarch is 800 pages long because it needs to be 800 pages long to give you that full experience of empathy and following through with these characters. That was her art. You know, she had a moral sense and a moral core, but she was not in the business of giving moral prescription. Thank goodness.
But she believed in those kindnesses adding up, and we've heard that. Is that a product of this kind of, I don't know if it's Belle Epoque, but certainly before World War One? I mean, was it? You think she would have been her own confidence in the cumulative weight and consequence of small acts might have been shaken by the 20th century, the next century, where the evil got so large?
Yeah, it might well have done. And had she been writing at a different time, she may well have had a different philosophy, or it would have shaped, she would have had to shape it to the dreadful consequences that we see in that happen in the 20th century. And so, you know, there's a kind of, you know, but even for George Eliot, I don't think she, when she writes about this melioristic faith, mm-hmm. it is done with a will and a desire for this to be true. She is not saying that it is easy, and she is not saying that if we're all nice to each other, the world will just be a happy place. And let's not, you know, she understood the tragedy of life and the seriousness of life and the weight of life. And I think that even reading her in the light of, you know, terrible things that happened after she was alive, you can still hold on to, as she held on to, this kind of slim hope that this melioristic faith is worth holding on to.
And she was, I mean, she brings characters to us who show that you can go with a big faith, with a big religious faith, and turn it into something destructive in itself. If you lose that empathy, you quote her saying, "There is no general doctrine which is not capable of eating out our morality if unchecked by the deep-seated habit of direct fellow feeling with individual fellow men." Gloria is calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Gloria, you're on the air with Rebecca Mead.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Rebecca. Rebecca, your book sounds great, but should I read Middlemarch first before I dive in? I haven't read Middlemarch. And I would love to read yours, but I want to get the most out of all of the allusions and everything that are in your book.
You do not have to read Middlemarch to read my book. I very much hope that it will encourage you and make you want to read Middlemarch afterwards, but I did not write this book only for people who already love and know Middlemarch. It will introduce you to George Eliot and introduce you to the book and introduce you to the idea, which I'm sure you've already had yourself, of the ways in which any great book, yours may not be Middlemarch, yours may be something else, but any great book can affect us so that we live through our lives with it as somewhere in the back of our head all the time, as a point of reference and a center of understanding for us. And that's what Middlemarch has been for me. But, you know, it could be another book for somebody else with equal validity. But the short answer is no, you do not need to read Middlemarch to read my book.
Gloria, try both and you'll have a happy 1,200 pages awaiting you or something there. Richard in Montreal, Canada. Richard, thanks for calling. You're on.
Yes, hi, Tom. I just want to say I'm very eager to read the author's book at the local library. And I'd like to just make a remark. One of my favorite novels, which kind of transformed me, was Thomas Mann's The Magic Mountain.
Yes, me too.
That was, I guess the Germans call it the Bildungsroman, or an education of a young man towards maturity. And I wanted to ask the author, is Middlemarch, would that be considered a Bildungsroman as well?
Rebecca?
Well, it is. I mean, it does give us these young characters. There is not just one. There are several who are at the outset of their lives and trying to figure out what they're going to do with their lives. There's Dorothea, but there's also Ladislaw, who she ends up marrying at the very end of the book after her first husband dies. There's Lydgate, the doctor, who's trying to figure out how he's going to make these medical advances and then is fatally curtailed by his marriage. And then there's Fred Vincey and Mary Garth, who are trying to work out whether they can come together or whether Fred is going to be worthy of Mary. So it is about the lives of these young people and these choices that they're going to make. But it's written, because it's written from this perspective of maturity and middle age, there is such wisdom and such compassion for the trials of youth. It's not written in the, you know, blurry frenzy of youth itself. It's written with this wonderfully wise, calm perspective and distance, and that's what I think gives it its great strength.
Not exactly the Magic Mountain, but thanks for the call. David in Bethesda, Maryland, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thank you for taking my call, and thanks for this great program. There are so many things that I read during transitions in my life. I had a life-changing motor vehicle accident when I was 21 years old, and I really transformed myself after that, really got my ego in check. Of all the things that I read, there's one that really stands out, and is the Letters to a Young Poet, a collection of letters to Rainer Maria Rilke, or from Rainer Maria Rilke, the poet, written in the early 19th.
Sure.
And it's so important to me that I've given it in travel kits to my friends when they go on journeys, and I've even bought copies for my children who are now 12. And they may be a little bit young for it, but I'm encouraging them to read it, and it's something that I pick up from time to time over the course of my years.
David, I love it. A life-changing
That's
motorcycle
beautiful.
Accident, and the next thing it's Rilke. But the idea of a book to grab onto, to raise our sights through, Rebecca, that's where you are.
Yes, and I think that, you know, when a great book seizes you and holds you in this way, it's such a precious thing. And that is what I wanted to do in my book, was to share that experience of having lived with a book throughout my whole life, so that I don't quite know who I would be without it. I think that, you know, many of us have different books that have meant that much to us in different ways. And it's always interesting to hear other people's most cherished volume. And what I wanted to do is tell the story of why this is mine.
And one more right here. Andrew, Brookline, Massachusetts. Andrew, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to make a comment because this conversation has really made me think about a book anchoring my life. The book that has anchored my life has been Brideshead Revisited, which I read at about 18 or 19, which is when the characters start their life journey. And I read it again when I was about 45, when the characters are older and the book is ending. And it was just a very powerful experience for me because I saw two different ends of life. And I guess I'm interested in reading it again in another 15 or 20 years when the older characters are ending the book.
A kind of constant touchstone that you're going to read and hear in different ways, be nourished by in different ways at different points. That's definitely what Rebecca Mead's up to. Andrew, I appreciate your call. Rebecca, here's a comment from our website from Bridget, and she says, "It's remarkable that you should have this show today. I just finished Middlemarch yesterday, savoring every word. It took me a week to finish the last chapter, not wanting the novel and the characters' stories to end, and realizing, in a way, the story never ends. The last paragraph," Bridget writes to us, "is especially meaningful. The impact that one person, Dorothea, can have on the world around them, and specifically the meaning of life in general." I think you have that last paragraph in your hand.
I do, and how wonderful to spend a week on that chapter, not wanting to leave her own life in Middlemarch.
I know that
she
feeling.
Is my kind of person, yes.
Introduce this last chapter of the whole great volume to us, and read it, if you would.
Yeah, this is the very final lines of Middlemarch, and it's speaking about Dorothea, with whom we began and with whom we're ending. "Her finely touched spirit still had its fine issues, though they were not widely visible. Her full nature, like that river of which Cyrus broke the strength, spent itself in channels which had no great name upon the earth. But the effect of her being on those around her was incalculably diffusive. For the growing good of the world is partly dependent on unhistoric acts, and that things are not so ill with you and me as they might have been is half owing to the number who lived faithfully a hidden life and rest in unvisited tombs."
The final paragraph from Middlemarch, that growing good of the world partly dependent on unhistoric acts. That's a sympathy with the little man and little woman, her provincial, but a very grand idea at the same time.
It is, and it's both inspiring and melancholy, I find, because, you know, Dorothea doesn't do all that we might have hoped that she does, and plenty of readers have been frustrated with her. And yet, George Eliot is telling us that, you know, all lives are worth living, and that we may not realize all of our hopes and dreams, but that we might realize enough, just enough, in our small, ordinary lives. I think for most of us, that's a great consolation, as well as being a kind of sadness in that final beautiful dying fall. I can't imagine reading this sentence and not sighing at the end of it.
Listen,
it is so, so beautiful.
Let me snag one more quick call. Jennifer, very quickly, you're on the air.
Yes, I want to know, why couldn't George Eliot marry her, the man she loved?
Rebecca.
He was married to somebody else and couldn't get a divorce. At least when they first got together, a divorce would have been completely impossible. And so they very bravely eloped and lived together in defiance of convention and had a pretty good time of it. They made their own private life, and they didn't care what people thought of them. And they got a lot of work done, they got a lot of reading done, and they loved each other very much.
She may have talked about unhistoric acts and unvisited tombs, but she was a rebel. She was, as you said at the outset, Rebecca, notorious.
She was notorious and, for me, very inspiring, extremely admirable, a great, fantastic, marvelous life to spend time with and thinking about. And yet gives us also the hope that those of us who live more ordinary lives might still, you know, have lives worth living.
Check it out. Rebecca Mead's new book is My Life in Middlemarch. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Rebecca Mead, you're so generous in the book and with us today. Just terrific to have you. We'll read you in a new way in the pages of The New Yorker, but thank you so much for bringing George Eliot and Middlemarch to us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Rebecca Mead, My Life in Middlemarch. Tomorrow in this hour, we will look at the deep history of American football. 400 years of history, our author says, as we march toward the Super Bowl. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.